All right, we're gonna go ahead and get started. I bet people are still gonna.
Who's awake?
Be getting back from lunch.
Okay.
For now.
But we're gonna start with just a small review, because it really kind of flows together. And for those of you who weren't here for the first session, then at least you'll have some idea what we're talking about. The first session we talked about, our stories, and then we went into kind of why this is a problem with our society that is very impatient but also dependent on technology, creates a perfect storm of sorts for pornography addiction in our world today. We then talked about the different drugs that our brain naturally produces that lend itself towards addiction. And then we talked about the cycle of addiction, which is fantasy, then setting up the stage, and then acting out, and then despair. And Jack left us off with, well, why don't, you know, when you get to the despair and you realize what you've done and you feel terrible about yourself, why doesn't that curve off into repentance instead of what it typically does is it keeps on going with the cycle? We're going to talk about that, that in this session of why that is a problem. But first, Jack's going to give us some ideas of what has been done about the problem thus far.
So we talked right at the end that we tend to respond to the problem with, we just won't talk about it and leave it kept under the rug, so that we, I don't know why we do it that way. Part of it is what we talked about before, that topics surrounding sex are uncomfortable. We can make a lot of excuses as far as when's the right time to discuss these things. Well, there's always kids here, so we probably shouldn't. There's a lot of excuses to not talk about it. And that's typically how it's handled. When we do decide to talk about it, there are a lot of wrong ways that we discuss that. And so we'll spend some time talking about that before we get into the solutions, because it's very possible that you are. You have, if you've talked about it, done one of these things to, even though you've broken your silence on it, help keep the people involved in it silent, because they don't feel like they can talk based on these solutions, quote unquote, we've given. The first is this: just don't do it. I mentioned before in the first class that I've been in a preacher's lunch where somebody, older preacher, said those perverts should just quit looking at it, and that was the solution to the problem. And he, I believe, even had a background in counseling, but still couldn't get the connection between these ideas. Just don't do it is exactly what the person who's involved in it would like to do and is thinking, and they've tried that. Just stop doing it. But again, as we've talked about the chemicals that are involved in all of this, there is a great pull chemically inside to continue the practice that you know is wrong and that you know you don't want to be involved in anymore. Number two, our general application for a lot of subjects. Have you tried reading your Bible / praying more? And I can tell you more than likely most of those people are reading and praying all the time, but it's not doing the trick. It's not helping with the problem. People who know their Bibles very well struggle with pornography. That's not the reason why they're stuck in pornography. It's not a lack of Bible knowledge, and it's not a lack of a prayer life or a relationship with God. That's why there's such despair towards the end of all of this, because they're very aware of what they're doing between their relationship with them and God. And praying more, reading more, that doesn't really fix the problem. It's an easy suggestion to make, though, to hope that that'll go away. Number three, just accept it. There are forums that I have looked at where women are asking other women, wives asking other wives, how much is too much? How much is the appropriate amount of pornography for my husband to watch? Because obviously it's what men do. It's perfectly fine. I just want to know how much. That's the approach now. Because pornography has been such a, it's a mainstay in the culture now. And because of that, it's becoming accepted in, well, this is what boys do. Boys will be boys. And now women are doing it too. It's just part of growing up and getting to understand who you are as a person. And in the marriage relationship, I've listened to people encourage it as part of your marriage relationship. You watch this together. And it can lead to a lot of great things, is what the suggestions have been.
There's marriage counselors out there who actually suggested no.
I didn't know that. I don't like that, though, either. We're accepting it. And encouraging just acceptance, that's not going to be something that we're likely to prescribe for the problem, but it is one that's out there and that the culture feeds out. Software and filters, we're going to talk here in a little bit about how those are part of the solution, but those in and of themselves do not solve the problem. When you think about filtering out or blocking websites, there are always ways around those. And as we talked about before, 71% of teens are hiding their online behavior where they go online from their parents. Being technology natives versus immigrants to technology, they're probably more aware of how to hide things from you and get around the technology you've set up, because, you know, as a parent, you might think, well, if I just download this, solves all the problems, they can't see it. That's simply not the case. But the other part of that too is, well, if I have this, let's say it blocks everything online. Both of our stories began with somebody in real life introducing it to us in person. So they're going to find it somewhere else, and you're going to end up with the situation where you never let the kid have any cake, and so they go to the birthday party, and there's a cake there, and you turn around, and, oh, why'd that kid eat 75% of the cake, and now they're throwing up on my kitchen floor? It's because they never have sugar, but when they get exposed to it, they go crazy on it. And so we're going to keep it blocked off. That's going to solve all my problems until they see it somewhere else, and then they're going to go crazy on it. So those are part of the solution. But those in and of themselves are not good enough. And then the last thing here, and this is, there are other websites, some you might even be familiar with, where their solution to the issue is just make people more aware that it is a problem. God doesn't really factor into the equation as far as their solution goes, and so it's spread awareness, and that awareness will eventually help us get to where we need to be, which again is simply not the case. It's a good starting point. That's why we have a part two to the first class. Part one was awareness. Part two is what do we do with it now? And some places stop short in that regard.
Absolutely.
Anything you want to add?
No. You did a good job.
Oh, thank you.
Good job. Relating this back to the Bible as we think about solutions, I think one of the most notorious sexual sins that we read about in the Bible has to do with David and Bathsheba, right? That's what typically we go to when we think of sexual sin. And David wrote Psalm 51 as his, okay, after Nathan came and called him, you know, you are the man and all of that jazz, and, you know, the child will die. David, in his grief and in his sorrow, writes Psalm 51. And if you read through Psalm 51, it is very heartfelt. You see a man who is broken, who realizes the gravity of his sin, and finally comes to grips with, oh, I just did all of this, and now what do I do? As he's talking to God, as he's crying out to God. Now, the problem was lust. It was sexual sin. Do you know the one thing that David doesn't mention in that psalm? Sexual sin. Because David realizes that although that was a symptom of the problem, that in and of itself is not the problem. What does David say? He says, restore to me the joy of my salvation. Right? That's what he's asking God to do. He doesn't say, God, take away my lust. God, you know, take away my adulterous heart. He says, restore to me the joy of my salvation. And what we found in our attempts to fix this problem in ourselves, and also with working with many men and couples around the world, is that is what we need. We need a group, a community of like-minded people who help us remember the joy of our salvation. What is at the heart of all of this And like I said before, pornography addiction has very little to do with pornography or sex at all. The chemicals are one side of it, but also we need to realize that pornography addiction has more to do with an intimacy disorder than anything else. Now, typically, when we think of intimacy, we think of, you know, holding hands with your loved one, walking, you know, down the beach and, you know, viewing a sunset or gazing into your spouse's eyes, and that's what intimacy is. And in fact, I was taking a class in my getting my master's degree in counseling that I asked this question to a group of counselors, and three of them, I asked them, what is intimacy? And three of them just blurted out, sex. And I was like, okay, wow. And that intimacy is also not sex. That's part of intimacy. That's physical intimacy. That's romantic intimacy. But intimacy by itself is just allowing people to see who you really are, right? One person explained it to me this way. It's kind of corny, but into me you see. Intimacy, right? It's allowing people to see who you really are. It's knowing and being known, right? And so when I think about intimacy in our relationship with God, that's why that relationship can be so intimate, right? Because God knows us. Even the things that we don't want to admit about ourselves, He knows us, and He still chooses to love us. And that level, that amount of love is unlike anything else. Because even our spouses don't know everything about us, and yet God does. And when you have an intimacy problem, this is why pornography fits into this category, an intimacy disorder. You don't allow people to see the real you. You think to yourself, if they knew who I really was, they would not love me. Or you start to degrade yourself. You start to have this self-hatred for yourself. Of if I am so dirty and disgusting that no one wants anything to do with me, if they knew what I was really struggling with. And that is what keeps the addict hooked. They keep silent. And the cycle just repeats itself. An intimacy disorder typically comes from three places: abandonment, abuse, and shame. Abandonment, abuse, and shame. And that's why when we talk about porn being a symptom of a larger problem, these three core issues, abandonment, abuse, and shame, they are far-reaching, in that someone probably is struggling with one of the three or have in their past. And it might just manifest itself in different ways. For the porn addict, it's, I cope with the pain of life by watching and acting out to pornography. Abandonment, you might think, abandonment issues, a lot of people have abandonment issues. And they're hard to spot unless you can get really real with yourself and start to think about everything that you've been through. I grew up in a broken home. My dad left the house when I was 4, and he didn't want very much to do with us after that. We saw him every once in a while. And so I know that me and my two brothers, we have abandonment issues. That feeling of I am unwanted has far-reaching implications. And that hurt can last a long time. Abuse, as Steve's been talking about in his classes, abuse is, it can be physical, emotional, verbal, sexual. All of those things constitute abuse, and abuse, again, especially from people who you're supposed to trust and who you think love you the most, when they abuse you, that hurt, again, can last a very long time and has big implications. And shame is this idea of I am unworthy. I don't deserve the things that I have. And shame is another one that it's hard to spot. I've talked to a lot of young people that say, well, I don't really have abandonment issues, I don't think. I can't think of any abuse. I feel like I have good self-esteem. Typically, there is some level of shame that is beneath the surface that they are unwilling or unable to target in their lives, and that is why they are struggling or reaching for something that can never fulfill the needs that they have.
And you think about, in regards to the intimacy disorder, we read a quote from the VP of operations in Facebook, who lamented what they had done with Facebook, giving us these feedback loops of moments where you feel good, but they're little moments, and we pretend that that is actual connection with people. And as Chris was saying, this letting down of our guard and being vulnerable with people has been replaced with putting your best self out there or your pretend self out there because we want to be liked and keep getting those pieces of feedback. And so it's become even harder. As technology gets better, pornography access gets easier, and the solution to it of being vulnerable with people becomes more and more difficult. And that divide is going to continue to increase as we see all this go along. So let's talk about the solution kind of in a
practical.
Yeah, there you go. I was going to say something else. That's better. Overcome groups are what we call it. So if you remember back to the stories we shared, Chris's and I's story ended the same. He picked up a book that he saw that explained this idea. That book, by the way, if you're writing things down, is Open. It's by Craig Gross. The book's called Open by Craig Gross. And that book kind of lays out what we're going to be talking about today a little more and gives some more examples and explanations about all of that. But he handed that book to me. I was one of the two friends he gave that to. And out of that, we started a group with, it was three guys. A couple more joined in not too long after that. And you're involved in three or four now. and these groups are really what we advocate for dealing with the issue. And we'll have time for Q&A here at the end to talk more about that to your questions. But overcome groups, part of that is this. First, you have software. We talked about filtering at the beginning of not being a solution in and of itself, but part of the solution. When you think about software, there are always ways around that, and there are two differences between them. You can have software that blocks websites, keeps you from going places and accessing things, which, if you have young children, think that's the way to go. You want to try, though they will very likely see it at some point, you want to try to keep them from that as much as you can. But in our groups, those that are older, we advocate using reporters. I can go anywhere I want on my computer. He can do the same, but he knows that there's going to be a report each week that goes to two other people that are in the group, and that we can see everything that he's doing and where he's going, and two other people can see everything I'm doing and where I'm going. And I know at any point I can be called out for it, but the big difference is I have the ability to make a bad decision if I want to. And so I have to have more self-control, or we're going to have discussion with one another. But in that discussion, this is part two. So with the groups, you have software. Safety is the next consideration. And that's safety in the discussion process. We'll talk specifically about parents with children because there's one difference between these two. But it's very common when a parent finds out to react in anger for a number of reasons. You know, I can't believe I didn't raise my son better, or how could I fail, or how could you do this? You know better than that. And anger is a very easy thing to tap into as a parent. What that does is the same thing that our silence or our bad solutions have done. Your child now is going to be more stressed out. The next time they think about going or actually go to it, they're going to go, well, I can't let mom find this out because she'll yell at me. She yelled at me last time. She was so mad. I can't let her find out again. And so now it's, I'm going to hide and continue to hide the behavior. We know that in a group setting, when one of us makes a mistake, we're going to talk about it. It's going to be brought up. There's no running from that. But the conversation often goes, what happened? How'd you get there? And a lot of the times it's, I found an iPod lying around, an old one I didn't know I had. It doesn't have the filter on it. It doesn't have the reporter on it. And so I stayed up too late. I had access to it. This is what happened. And in some cases, they're just being honest about the fact that they failed that week and we wouldn't have known otherwise because they don't have the reporter on there. So what do we do in result of that? How can we fix the problem now? Well, I've put the reporter on there, you're going to get emails from me, and that's, we hold them accountable to that, and we can see the devices and all that that we get from. But they don't get yelled at. We don't run them down How could you make a mistake like this? We know it's bad. We all know it's bad. That's why we're in the group. We don't need to be reminded about how bad it is. And if you remember the cycle, they have this tremendous feeling of guilt and despair from having done it. They don't need to be reminded another time about how terrible it is what they just did. They need to know the way out. And that way out is, listen, we've all been there. That's why we start with the stories. We've all been there. You know what happened to cause you to go look. You've done something about it. And we're gonna check up on you each week when we do this. And that's part number three. Software safety structure is number three to this. These are weekly groups. And we'll get together on Skype. We're all over. He's in Pennsylvania. I'm in Oklahoma. And there are others scattered out, Colorado and other places. So we get together on Skype as much as we can, as much as everybody can be there. We know the time, know how to get to each other, and we talk. And we have a list of questions. Chris will go into that a little more here in just a moment. But we go through and ask each other the things we want to be kept accountable on. And everybody has a question about pornography. You have to be a part of the group. And it's that intimacy and closeness that has caused us to, I know if I do this, there's two other guys that are going to see it. And when I'm in group, there are going to be four or five other guys that are going to be in that conversation. But we've all been there, and we're all dealing with it. Anything to add to that?
I would say just one thing to add as far as the safety is concerned, and like why do we do it the way that we do? This typically makes some wives really upset, but for part of it, I wish my wife was here because she could just explain it so much better.
She'll back him up on this.
Yeah, she got my back. But for a lot of people, let's say, okay, husband is struggling with pornography. He doesn't want to tell the church, right? He doesn't want to tell his elders. So I'll just, as difficult as it is, I'll just tell my wife, and I'll ask her to be my accountability partner. Sounds fine. And for some people, that works out, and that's fine. The problem that we have found time and time again is that that is a fear-based accountability model, meaning that the fear of my wife finding out is going to keep me from watching porn. And again, for some guys, that works. For a lot of guys, it doesn't. And what that actually does is this encourages them to lie more.
It's that parent-child relationship thing with my mom's going to be mad so she can't find out.
So we provided an environment where they can come and actually tell the truth and confess. We're trying to take out any hurdles that might be in their way of lying. Because when you come to group and you're with other guys who might have also failed that week or looked at pornography that week, they know that I am accepted here. Now, the goal isn't, all right, we're going to keep our wives in the dark forever. But it is for a time, and that is so that this whole thing is about intimacy, right? How do you cure an intimacy disorder? You learn to get intimate. If you cannot be intimate with your wife, right, if you're encouraged to lie to her, the way you get over that is you learn to tell the truth to other people. And then you keep doing that, and you keep doing that, and before long you learn that, oh, I can tell my wife the truth too. And that's the process that we suggest.
So I want to change the last one there. It's software safety, and this is in relation to parent and children in this relationship. That third S is going to be support there, and that is very much this patience, open communication sort of atmosphere. One of the, and if you go and get open, you'll read this. Craig's son at school, he and a friend were exposed to pornography there, or maybe they had seen it before, but they were shown it by another student. And Craig's son came home and said, somebody at school showed this to me. And so Craig called the other kid's dad and said, do you know what our sons saw today at school? And he said, I had no idea. Because in one scenario, Craig, in his home, this is open communication. Yeah, you saw it, but I'm not going to yell at you. I'm not going to get mad. You know that it's not okay. And he came home and said, Dad, somebody showed this to me. I just want you to know. The communication was open there because he knew how his dad was going to respond. In the other side of that, the friend doesn't tell his dad. What's my dad going to do? This isn't good. I shouldn't tell him. I don't know what's going to happen. There wasn't support there. And so if you want your children to be honest with you as parents, you have to have that in every other aspect of the relationship. Communication and patience. Hear them out and let them know that it's safe to talk to mom and dad about these things.
And also starting the conversation early and often.
Yes.
Something we also suggest. Again, age appropriate. You can't like tell a 3-year-old of what hardcore pornography is, but in their mind it's the same thing. I mean, if you have kids, you know, they start asking where do babies come from, or you know, like what is sex, and so you explain it to them in a way that is appropriate for their age. And the same thing should be done with pornography. They are going to see it. And so I would hate for one of my kids to not know about this at all and then to be exposed to it, and then, you know, what do I do? My kids know what to do. They know that this is out there, and they know that they can come talk to me or their mom anytime.
Yeah, and sex being an uncomfortable conversation, I say this having a 5-year-old, so it's not like I've had the talk with my kids yet, but knowing that that's a difficult conversation, and it's one that's difficult for us to have in church settings as well, if you don't talk to your kids about this stuff, somebody else will, and it's not going to be what you want them to hear about it. What we're finding a lot is in the process of getting over the porn addiction, you have to tear a building down, then get the foundation, and then start building the right building. Because people are growing up, the church not telling them what God created sex for and the context that it's great in and that it is a gift. We're not telling them that. And so they're growing up hearing, this is what sex is, and here you can watch it, and this is how it's supposed to go, and this is what it looks like. And they have nothing to bounce that off of. Well, don't they read their Bibles? Well, yeah, but we tell them not to read the Song of Solomon stuff, things like that. It's in there, but we don't talk about it. And so they have nothing to compare it against. And so they go into marriage relationships thinking, well, sex is bad is what we heard growing up in church, so it must be bad. I don't know what to do here. And yeah, so talk about it. We've got about 13, by the way, 13 okay. minutes.
Really quickly, how we set up our groups is 5 simple steps. Number one, get your guys.
Or girls.
Have yet to cross that one yet. We don't have a Overcome Girls group yet. We'd love to have one, though. I just don't know who would do it. Anyways, you get your people, and you can do that any way that you know how. For me, it was I've had conversations with guys in the past. I know that these two struggle with this, and so I talk to them. For you... I mean, for preachers, it might be as simple as, oh, this person came to me and said, I struggle with this. Boom. You got one of your guys right there. Many different ways you can do that. Number 2 is write your rules. We have a charter that's in our group that's they understand. Anyone that joins the group, they sign the paper. This is a covenant agreement that they are entering into, that they will follow the rules to the best of their ability, and that they will, you know, adhere their lives to what they what we agree to, what they should be. Number 3 is confess. That's the storytelling part for a lot of people, especially if they've been caught up in pornography addiction for a long time. They have never ever told their story to anyone. And part of the healing process is doing exactly that. Let them tell their story. I tell my story just like I did, except for I go into a lot more detail, and I do that for really one reason, is so that they know that I'm not going to blush at anything they say. That my story, it's my story, and I don't, you know, just embellish it for, you know, no reason, but I want them to feel safe, and that whatever they say, as horrible as it might be, it's going to be accepted. And I'm not going to, you know, turn my back on them. I'm not going to blush. it's your story and you need to be able to tell it. That's number three, confess. Number four is get your questions. As Jack alluded to, everybody in our group has questions that are asked of them every single week. For a lot of guys, myself included, I've been in accountability groups before where it's kind of like, all right, let's meet once a month. Someone asks, hey, anybody got a struggle? And everyone looks around the room really awkwardly, everyone knowing what each other's thinking, but no one's saying, like, I have a problem with porn. No one says that, right? It's just an awkward, you might get a, hey, I'm struggling in my prayer life right now. They might be. But is that really the problem that they're dealing with? No. And so what we did, we took that out. We said, you're going to develop your questions, and you're going to get asked these questions every single week. So you cannot hide from this. All right? And number five, we meet weekly. We chose a week because we felt that's what we needed for support. Beyond just like answering the questions and giving advice and strategies, it has become an amazing time of encouragement. And I mean, you're sharing some of the most intimate parts of your life with these people. They're going to know something about you. Like I said before, I have a group that is just preachers. There's only preachers in this group besides my friend. We adopted him. He's kind of a preacher. we allow. And so, like, you know, we talk about things that we're struggling with in our ministry, and you know, I pose Bible questions to other people in the group because they're smarter than I am, and so like it becomes, I don't know, it's like family almost, you know. And I think, are you going to cover that?
Sure. Yeah, we got to wrap up. Let people have questions.
Can you explain that number four, getting questions?
Yes. Probably, it's like six questions.
I'll tell you my questions.
Yeah, go for it.
As an example, I have four questions that are asked of me every week. Number one, did you watch pornography this week? That's my number one question.
And that's just about for that one.
That's typically
or
the same
something like that.
For every guy in the group. Something similar to that, or like, were you clean this week? Did you watch pornography and masturbate this week? Something similar to that. It's very on the nose, no trying to, you know, get around the bush. It's like, this is the question. Did you watch pornography this week? Number two, because this is where we found most guys, as they start getting better, they struggle more with lust. And so my number two question is, did I look at a woman
in a lustful manner?
Did I look at a woman in a lustful manner this week? Because that's, for me personally, that's where I'm fighting my battle now. That I might not be acting out to it with pornography, but looking at a girl in the gym or, you know, running on the road, I still struggle with that. And so I know that if I let that fester and I don't talk about that, it's going to grow. And unless I confess that and get that off of my chest, it could turn into something bad and I'll be right back to where I started. Number three and four are, for most of the guys in the group, have nothing to do with pornography or lust. Mine is, did you study with your wife this week? That's something that I want to be better at and teach my wife what I know about the Bible and have that intimacy and closeness with her. And number four, my four has changed a lot. Right now it's, how was your prayer life this week? Mine's been, have you read half a book this week? Have you gone to the gym four times this week? Anything and everything can be part of your questions. Because it's really about guys getting together, realizing where we're deficient in, and trying to get better.
So each person develops their own questions for an accountability type thing.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Any more thoughts, questions?
So, we can just open it up. Any questions?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, as a minister, you know, you talked about being in a group with a lot of preachers. Is there a point where if someone shares something that you think, like, yikes, this guy is working with people? You know what I mean? I mean, when you're that intimate and you share things, and I understand, you know, I've got friends that we talk about things and share things, and certainly I want to work with them, but what do you do in a situation where someone says something and you're like, I mean, do you encourage them, hey, you need to talk to your elders? Do you, what do you do?
I would, depending on the thing, right? Like this
right.
is,
I know.
Depending on the thing, I would, and also everyone in the group also realizes that this isn't professional counseling, right? This is kind of like the last step before, and we've had guys in group, and we've also encouraged guys like, okay, like what we're providing, like it's not working, and I think you should go find a local sex addicts group or find a counselor, find someone that is more specialized in this that can give you the attention that you need. And so we've had to do that in the past, and also encouraging them to keep their wives in the loop, right? So it's not like, all right, I'm having a secret meeting with the guys. Because that's what it's all about, is increasing intimacy. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's good.
I think it just depends. Like, this guy's thinking about killing someone. We should
probably,
tell someone.
Someone, my buddy and I were talking about this. He asked an interesting question. He's on the phone now, so I'll ask it.
Okay, never mind.
Is there any sense of, this is your question, Mike. Is there any sense of guys who they seek help after they've been busted versus guys who seek help once they come to the realization that I just need to do this before they're busted?
Like telling the difference between those two mindsets, is that?
Yeah, not questioning the sincerity of either of them.
Sure.
Just asking, it seems like most people who begin the process of healing do it because they were kind of forced into it, versus someone who says, man, I've been struggling with this, I gotta get help. Any feel for how much of that happens, or does the process unfold differently?
I think our group, and you're in more groups, but in the group that I'm a part of, we don't get that feel from people. There was one guy, in the past.
Oh, that one guy.
You know, that one guy. you could kind of tell in some of the answers and some of the speech that okay, he's not being fully honest with us, and he's holding back, that, you know, the answers are short, or you can just tell in the speech, but that's not the norm. Most of the time, if you're willing to walk into a group and say, because when a new guy comes in, that's why I asked about how many times he shared that story. When a new guy comes in, we hear the story again, and everybody in the group reshares, and then the new person shares where they're at. And somebody who's willing to do that is probably willing to make the change. That's what we found so far, anyway. Though we have had some people that have kind of been encouraged to, maybe you should be a part of this group because they got caught by somebody else, but they won't stick around if that's the case.
I would say for the most part, married guys, they got caught and they need something. Single guys, I mean, who's going
to
catch them?
We had somebody email us and say, guys, I need to make this change. I wanted to come and talk to you guys. And we said, guess what? We have a group going on that we're just now starting. And so our group went from 3 to 5 really fast. Mm-hmm. But that was a single guy looking out. It is true. Normally the married men are caught and you need to get help or we're going to have marriage problems. Mm-hmm. But even then, once those guys are in, if they're willing to tell the story and stick around a few weeks, we have had some guys just leave. Yeah. But we've had guys stay, even though it was you got caught, because now they know what they have with the group. Yeah. Other questions?
I've only had 2 come voluntarily. I'm a sex addiction therapist. Out of the 150 men I've worked with, I've had 2 that came on their own, all the rest of them got caught.
Hmm.
And half my clientele has been members of the church.
If you weren't here for the stats at the beginning, there it is.
Is there ever a point at which it feels like it's enabling? You know, where the therapy itself, like the actual, and I'm just drawing from a recent experience I had. It was a preacher's meeting, and one of the local preachers came in, and like as we're taking our opening announcements, he was like, hey, I looked at porn yesterday. I told my wife, I prayed to Jesus about it. It's good. And I almost felt like in that situation it was, he's done this before.
Yeah.
This has happened, and he's used to just confessing. And the confession itself was just part of the, it was almost enabling. You know, where do you draw the line between, you know, you're confessing and that's good, and there has to be fruits of repentance somewhere. there has to be, change has to happen, right? I mean, it's not just this, the intention is not, there has to, just like there's an on-ramp, there has to be an off-ramp.
Right.
Or at least there should be, right? We want to recover, not just, you know, have accountability, but the recovery aspect of that. Can you speak to that for a minute?
That's a big part of the reporters, the website reporting thing, is that we know we're going to get called out by the other guys, and they're going, it's not an angry environment, but they're also not, we don't just let things slide on by either. We get pressed of, well, hold on, because it, right. You said you were good in your question, but what about these two instances here that explain it? And we have had instances where that was a very good thing that we pressed on, because they were lying about the other answer, trying to get the easy out of, well, I prayed about it and we're fine.
I think to add to that as well, we meet every week, right? And so although it's not, you know, like our questions are all geared towards that week, right? Because for the guy that's struggling, like, all right, you confessed it, put it behind you, now let's focus on this week. But with that too, we also notice trends. And so when we notice a trend saying, hey, I was on Instagram again, and that's what started it. It's like, okay, well, we see that trend for a few weeks in a row, and we have the conversations. Like, do you think you can handle having Instagram then? And so it's not a, all right, you know, thanks for sharing, and we'll move on. But we challenge each other in that time, too, of saying, hey, you keep on doing this. You know, like, what are some things that you can think of to stop it?
We've had guys get rid of Instagram, get rid of Twitter for that reason, that they continued. And so we pressed, and they said, well, if you really want to get better, you should get it out of there. And we know when those things get uninstalled and installed as well as part of the report.
But they, I mean, part of like our charter of being in the group is that you have to want it, right? You have to want to get better. And so we start seeing that, like, well, yeah, I did it again.
Sure.
I mean, that's not, why are you in the group then? Like, do you want to get better?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess that's why you want to be long-suffering with this kind of thing, right?
Yes.
You don't want to put a time stamp on it, but at the same time, I don't know, there has to, I guess, you know, what does that look like when there comes a point where the person is just not overcoming? You know, at what point, what does the, hey, this is not helping you, you need to go up to the next level.
You're right, it's hard to put a timestamp on that, because like a person's journey could be like, oh, he's doing really great for 6 months, and then he's got a bad time for an extended period of time. I think at that point, like in the situation you just laid out, I think it would be like a conversation of, have you thought about professional counseling?
We're out of time. I think we'll hang around for a little bit after to talk, but I want to end with this thought about all this. Most of what we've seen are guys drastically improving over their time being involved in this, because when you know you're talking to other Christian guys who have been there that get it, we've watched guys go from, I look at it multiple times a week, to it's not as much of a struggle at all anymore. And they're still in group because you continue to fight against it so it doesn't come back. But there's been this tremendous growth. And if you remember nothing else, and this is true of so many of the conversations that you've listened to this week, David writes Psalm 51 because Nathan walks in and says, you've done something you know wasn't right. He needed that person to keep him accountable. And you continue on into 1 Kings, and Nathan's still there with David. They're friends, and you need that if you're going to get better. Same thing is true, very true, with this. That's it, but if you have questions, then you can ask us up here. Thank you very much.